Meditation. For some, it's an endeavor. For some, it's a fashion. For me, and for most, it's understanding the fundamental nature of being human. We're all built the same way. The framework for being human is constant throughout the world. No matter what religion you prescribe to, no matter which ethnicity you were born and raised, whether you're conservative or progressive in your beliefs, we are all human. Meditation is not a Buddhist thing. It is not an Eastern thing. It is paying attention to the nature of who you are, a time dedicated to observing consciousness and its contents. Meditation, psychedelics, and the default mode network. Why are they all in the same sentence? Well, you're about to find out. Well, welcome, humans, friends. Thank you for joining me. It has been a little while. I have had the last few weeks off social media, which has been interesting, to say the least. You know, as humans, we are extraordinarily susceptible to social validation, especially in times of prolonged isolation where you don't see your close friends as much as you usually do. And so, to get that social validation, we often seek things like Instagram or other forms of social media, and I was finding I was overusing it, and it was certainly a burden on my life, but I am feeling much better now. I have also been working alongside Mind Medicine, which I will touch on later in this episode, about what Mind Medicine are and what I'm doing with Mind Medicine. It will start to make sense because the title of this episode is very much similar to the work that I have been doing with Mind Medicine. But I hope you're feeling good. I'm Tommy Moore, host of this show. Welcome or welcome back. Mind Body Plants, it's a podcast that explores the spectrum of health, exercise, nutrition, sleep, meditation, managing stress, social connection, brain function, meaningful work. We all know they help, but do we really have to do everything perfect to feel fantastic? Absolutely not. I don't want to give off the impression that we need to do everything perfectly, but the greater diversity and volume of whole foods that we eat, the more we move our bodies, the more we meditate, the more we invest in ourselves through these day-to-day lifestyle choices, the better we're going to feel. And we must know what nourishes and serves our body, because when we nourish and serve our body, our mind follows. And when our mind and body are coherent, we feel balanced, we feel connected, we feel good. And life will give you whatever experience is most helpful to improve yourself. If you are feeling stressed, anxious, depressed, disheartened, isolated, they're all feelings for a reason. It's how our body tells us that it's out of balance or out of alignment. And it's our job to find what it needs to be realigned. But the issue often is, many of us don't have the tools or the knowledge to do that. This is never about having a title to your lifestyle, but understanding the science. What is healthy for us? What isn't? Sometimes it's difficult to translate what the body feels into an actionable outcome, but nonetheless, we must try to find it. Anyway, let's get to it. Meditation, psychedelics, and the default mode network. In recent years, the study of meditation and psychedelics have seen some incredible developments. On a personal level, I have researched psychedelics more than any other field of science. And the more I research these medicines, the more fascinated I become with the phenomenology of human consciousness. For those that know me personally, know that I've been working rigorously on creating a brand new podcast that explores this topic in isolation. I'm extremely privileged to join forces with Mind Medicine Australia to further my investigation in psychedelic therapies by chatting to psychologists, neuroscientists, neurologists, psychiatrists, and leaders in psychedelic-assisted therapies across the world to shine a light on breakthrough therapies for mental illness and enabling the development of regulatory-approved and research-backed medicine-assisted psychotherapies for the treatment of mental ill health in Australia. If you are interested in psychedelics and their potential in psychiatry and society, or even if you're new to psychedelics and get to the end of this episode intrigued in this exciting field of research, please check out the Mind Medicine podcast, which I will link in the show notes. For those that are new to psychedelics or perhaps aren't fully aware of what they are, let's start with some key definitions and some history. Psychedelics are powerful, mind-altering, serotonergic substances that alter perception and mood. The word psychedelic is based on the Greek words psyche, referring to the mind or consciousness, and delos, meaning clear, visible. In other words, and by definition, psychedelics is mind-manifesting or mind-revealing. They have this ability to disrupt normal waking consciousness and reveal the deepest aspects of consciousness and encourage investigation of our inner being. Plant-based psychedelics, including but not limited to psilocybin, the active compound in magic mushrooms, and DMT, the psychoactive component of the South American spiritual healing ritual ayahuasca, and many other plant-based psychedelics, have a rich ancient history of medicinal use. As far as we can tell, there is no culture in the history of Homo sapiens that did not engage in a psychedelic practice or ritual. Well, aside from one, the Inuits. They were a tribe from the North Arctic, and none of it grew there. The history dates back millennia. For many cultures and tribes, psychedelic rituals were used for spiritual awakening, and many mystics believe their use gave birth to religion. These contemplative traditions explicitly aim at dissolving the sense of self or the ego, and often combined with shamanic drumming or meditative practices to complement the altered state of consciousness. Modern psychedelic research began when Albert Hofmann first synthesized lysergic acid dimethylamide, LSD, in 1938. In the 1950s and 60s, psychedelics had a huge impact on psychiatry, with LSD therapy being used to treat alcohol addiction, depression, anxiety, and other mental health disorders with high rates of remission. But, as most of us have been made conditionally aware, is that psychedelics became inextricably intertwined with this counterculture movement of the 1960s. These drugs had escaped the lab and were used by the young, by teenagers and people in their 20s, and it created this unusual generation gap, a splitting of two generations. It presented itself like a rite of passage, as you go in one person and come out a completely different person. And it's interesting because a rite of passage usually binds a culture together, but young people were the ones who were mostly doing this, and it was taking them into the country of the mind adults knew very little about. And mass amounts of people joined forces and protests against the current way of living, against the system, leading to fear and anxiety that ultimately brought the Nixon government to criminalize the use of psychedelics and declare a war on drugs. Psychedelics were then considered unsafe for human consumption and of no therapeutic use. This led to a 30-year hiatus in the research, 3 decades without any research. But that research has finally begun again. Like many others, the first 20 years of my life, I had associated psychedelics with some sort of psychotic breakdown, and had been exposed or seen ads of people jumping off buildings or scrambling and screaming on the ground. And given the cultural backlash of this era, we need to be extremely careful to ensure that this divergence doesn't happen again. Now, to reintroduce psychedelics, we must be very clear of its set and setting. Set refers to mindset and psychological expectations, and setting is the physical environment, as well as the clinician-patient relationship. Set and setting are crucial elements for facilitating paradigm-shifting mental patterns and recognizing positive outcomes. Regardless of where you sit in terms of its reintroduction to society, whether you're an advocate for recreational use or strictly supporting clinical research, it begins with education. People need to be made aware of what these substances are doing. This is not a normal drug, and we need to be mindful that the word drug really contains no meaning. When you put heroin, caffeine, alcohol, and paracetamol in the same category, it has very little value, and we need to desensitize ourselves from the word drug, because drug really only means an altered state, and an altered state can be achieved through going for a run, doing some breath work, having some food. just about everything that we do changes our biochemistry to some degree. And we're not asking for psychedelics to be handed out to anyone on the street. They need to be treated with the utmost respect and guided by a trained facilitator. Because when you enter the deepest, darkest parts of your mind, it's incredibly helpful to have a hand by your side. That's why it's psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. We're not asking for people to freely hand out these substances. We're asking for a trained facilitator to have the opportunity to provide regulatory-approved, research-backed psychotherapy with the assistance of psychedelic compound. Taking psilocybin on a guided journey is fundamentally different than taking magic mushrooms before a concert. My concern is that if the demands for these experiences exceeds the understanding of these substances, the potential for things to go wrong goes up drastically. These substances are not panaceas. They don't reorganize and resolve everything. But given the recent clinical trials and forthcoming results, they are indicative of a transdiagnostic action with the potential for treating depression, anxiety, addiction, post-traumatic stress disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and more recent research is even looking into Alzheimer's and dementia. Based on the results we are seeing in clinical research settings across the globe, psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy can lead to remission in 60 to 80% of cases of anxiety and depression, which is massive. Whereas current existing treatments lead to remission in about 30 to 35% of people. So, current treatments do help some people, but most people are not affected by current treatments. So there is a dire need for innovation in the mental health space. And the recent results have actually led the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, the American version of the TGA for Australia, to grant psilocybin and MDMA breakthrough therapy designation to fast-track the approval process. Now, breakthrough therapy is only granted when something is far superior to existing treatments. And I can tell you now, the research in this space is absolutely incredible. Anyway, I thought I'd give you a little snapshot into the psychedelic space before we venture further into meditation and the default mode network. It's now to the crux of the episode. What have psychedelics got to do anything with meditation? Well, good question. So, pharmacology is the science of drug action. How do drugs do what they do? Where do they act? What are their effects? How long do they last? Psilocybin and its active metabolite, psilocin, are tryptamines, a chemical family that includes the neurotransmitter serotonin. Because of its chemical similarity to serotonin, psilocin activates some of the brain receptors that serotonin acts upon, in turn leading to altered perceptions and cognitions, and can occasion mystical or spiritual type experiences in people. We know very little about the brain, and even less about consciousness. The difficulty with material science is that we're only working at the level of the brain. We don't know how consciousness arises. What we do know is that when certain regions of the brain light up or turn off, this can induce profound alterations in our conscious state. The increased focus on meditation in cognitive neuroscience and the renaissance of psychedelic research has brought about some remarkable insights. Both psychedelics and meditation exert huge changes in consciousness, perception, and cognition. What is strikingly similar about these two seemingly different modalities is that of the alterations in self-referential processing regions of the brain. The default mode network, or the DMN, is a network of brain regions that primarily includes the medial prefrontal cortex, posterior cingulate cortex, and the inferior parietal lobe, and is responsible for self-reference, referring to traits and descriptions of oneself, theory of mind, thinking about thoughts of others and what they're thinking, mental imagery, emotions of oneself, reflecting on one's emotional state, and what is called the autobiographical self. This brain region is the seat of the self, to the extent that we can say that, in terms of brain imaging. But again, empirical evidence can only take us so far. It's the phenomenology of these two modalities that is reported to be very similar. And there is increasing evidence of the overlap between the phenomenology as well as the neurophysiology of meditation practices and psychedelic states. The altered state of consciousness induced by classical psychedelics, like psilocybin or LSD, can somewhat mirror that of the meditative state. I don't just mean thinking with your eyes closed when I say meditation, but the meditative state is something that takes years and years of practice. The difficulty is conducting and funding a medical experiment on fundamentally healthy patients, like that of long-term meditators. It's very hard to come by, but brain imaging studies have opened a new window into the neurophysiological mechanisms of psychedelics and also the study of consciousness itself. I want to bring your attention to a study published in 2019 called Psilocybin-Assisted Mindfulness Training Modulates Self-Consciousness and Brain Default Mode Network Connectivity with Lasting Effect. I'll put this and other papers in the show notes for those that are interested in further reading. Anyway, this study investigated the psychedelic effects of psilocybin within a mindfulness retreat through brain imaging, specifically fMRI scanning. They conducted a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study with 38 participants following a single administration of the psychedelic psilocybin. They found decoupling of medial prefrontal and posterior cingulate cortices, which is thought to be self-referential processing regions of the brain and is part of the DMN. The extent of altered self-experience and connectivity predicted lasting positive changes. Interestingly, both meditation and psychedelics reduce activity in the default mode network. And this brain imaging reveals that long-term meditators, that of 10,000 hours or more of practice, compared with a non-meditator who has been administered a significant amount of psilocybin, shows that the activity of the default mode network is very, very similar. Both meditation and psychedelics are suspected to disrupt self-consciousness, that is, identifying oneself with the body and the mind that it inherits, and all of its underlying processes. But this hypothesis needs cautious consideration. A psychedelic experience is not a guarantee of long-lasting change, however. The crucial part is what you do with them. Also, there are many variables involved in distinguishing the distinction between these two modalities, like the style of meditation. It could be focused meditation, transcendental, holotropic breathwork, or mantra chanting. We also need to consider the drug and dosage used, personal factors such as the level of experience and certain personality traits. So in saying this, there is an entire spectrum of states of consciousness, but these states are sensitive to many different factors, but are in addition to the specific inducers that I mentioned earlier, the muting of the default mode network. Meditative practices aim to reduce self-regulation and self-referential processing. In a guided meditation session, you're told to harness your attention on specific things, like the breath or parts of the body, and to notice when the mind begins its seemingly endless tangent of logic and reasoning. That is the practice, noticing when the default mode network lights up. As a result of this, self-consciousness may be best construed as a multidimensional construct, and that when there is a sense of loss of self or dissolving of ego or ego dissolution, this can take several forms. A psychedelic experience tends to dissolve the ego and the boundary between self and others. Both mindfulness meditation and psychedelics are working to resolve DMN dominance associated with excessive rumination. They seem to alter circuits slightly differently, however. Mindfulness meditation additionally targets areas related to interoception, the internal states of the body, like feelings of hunger or warmth, and also executive control, whereas psilocybin and other classical psychedelics seem to have a more widespread effect on functional integrity, potentially promoting flexible cognition due to its randomness of firing effect, where more of the brain is connected to each other, and this can manifest as new ideas or new perspectives, which is why it's been so successful in the trials with depression, anxiety, and other mental health disorders, because this ability to disrupt your normal thought pattern gives a window and space into creating a new way of thinking like I said, new ideas or new perspectives. And we also have to be mindful that our self is continuously integrating the sensory information into real-time data that you, the consciousness, receives. It's relaying that information and drawing a line between you and what you experience, building about a subject-object experience. You being the subject, and everything that you see, touch, hear, smell, taste is the object of your consciousness. So if we are to mute this ego or turn down its activity through meditation practice or forcefully through psychedelics, we will get a dissolution of this sense of separation. And this brings about a sense of oneness and connection to everything. It's not always guaranteed to be blissful, like I've just described, however. The ego will fight to its death to be at the center of your attention. It's why we find it so difficult to focus sometimes, and why it's so hard to break the loop of ruminating thoughts. Further research is, of course, necessary to the anatomical and physiological extent to which these mental illnesses exert their forces. Because we don't have a brain model that says, this is depression, or this is the brain model with anxiety, it makes it very difficult to then suggest that using something else to counteract this brain image of a particular mental illness. But we do know that heightened activity in the default mode network suggests a lot of referring to yourself. I'm not worthy. I don't deserve happiness. I can't do this. Why am I sad? Why am I angry at myself for not being happy? Why can't I just be happy? We're all human. We've all felt this. We need to go to work daily on what we're telling ourselves. I don't want to point a finger at direct causation of mental illness because I completely understand the immense complexity of mental health conditions. What we don't know about psychoactive compounds far exceeds what we do know. But one thing is becoming certain. Their effectiveness in treating a range of psycho-emotional disorders can no longer be ignored. But what we do know is that when this network appears to be quiet, there's an ego dissolution, sometimes referred to as a mystical experience, although they're very much the same thing. One is more of a spiritual vocabulary, one is a psychodynamic vocabulary. What we do know, based on material science, that the increased activity in the default mode network is correlated with feelings of depression and anxiety. So it's a reasonable hypothesis to suggest that disruption in this region of the brain can bring about profound perspective changes. And it's these perspective changes, how we see the world, is what's so important about resolving mental barriers that are almost always self-imposed. And often the argument against psychedelic therapies is that there isn't enough research. Well, the answer to there's not enough research is more research. As it stands in Australia and the US, that psychedelics have no therapeutic potential, which is crazy because the research that has come out in the last 10 to 15 years shows that 60 to 80% of people are being improved by a psychedelic experience with a trained facilitator. So it's frustrating to see that the stigma is still lagging on from 30 years ago. So part of my work is, of course, breaking that stigma and educating people about these substances because they have so much potential across a wide range of mental health conditions. Hopefully I've given you some insight into the psychedelic space. As mentioned earlier, if you are interested in learning more about this, I have dedicated an entire podcast to exploring it, where I interview leaders in this space from around the world. So I won't be posting as much about this topic in this podcast, but if you did enjoy this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or share it with a friend. If you have any comments or questions related to this episode, you're welcome to send me a message on Instagram. That is at mindbody_plants. Otherwise, you can send me an email, contact@mindbodyplants.co. But that's it from me. I'll see you here for the next one.